The Takeaway is supported by Blue Apron, delivering gourmet recipes and fresh ingredients right to your door. Listeners get their first three meals free at blueapron.com/takeaway. That's blueapron.com/takeaway.
Hey guys, this is The Takeaway for Wednesday, August 3rd, 2016.
This isn't a situation where you have an episodic gaffe.
Actually, I was only kidding. You can get the baby out of here.
This is daily and weekly.
Just so you understand, he's not going to go into Ukraine. Dan, you can take it anywhere
you want. Well,
he's
already there, isn't he?
Okay, well.
Where they are distancing themselves from statements he's making.
I think I made a lot of sacrifices.
There has to be a point at which you say, this is not somebody I can support.
I don't regret anything. I said nice things about the son.
Even if he purports to be a member of my party.
Every day.
Every day.
Every day.
Every day.
There are strange things happening every day.
People don't understand.
Every day.
That's okay.
Every day.
I love that.
Feel that very strongly.
Every day.
Don't blame Donald Trump for that.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. And listen to that. Could the discreet exodus from the Trump campaign by the unlikely likes of John Kasich and Jeb Bush and not so discreet Ted Cruz become a real stampede? I mean, what does it say when Bernie Sanders, Michael Bloomberg, and Richard Armitage are all supporting the same candidate? Add to that list Meg Whitman, a big-time Republican fundraiser and Hewlett-Packard executive, called the Republican nominee Donald Trump a demagogue this week and announced she would instead be voting for Hillary Clinton. New York Republican Congressman Richard Hanna has also added his name to the growing list of defectors. The recent insensitive statements by Trump about the family of Kazir Khan have brought supportive GOP leaders like Paul Ryan and Mitch McConnell closer to a possible moment of truth. There is now an entire PAC, Political Action Committee, dedicated to helping them get there. Craig Snyder, chairman of the Republicans for Her PAC, is with me now. Thanks for joining The Takeaway.
Thank you. Well, great to be here.
So what motivated this, aside from a lot of disgruntlement associated with Donald Trump, and why do you need a PAC, a political action committee, to actually enforce this sort of thing?
Well, the motivation is, as corny as it may sound, love of country and fear of the future of the country were Trump to be elected. PACs are groupings of like-minded people who are willing to put time and money together to advance a message and support a cause. So it's the right vehicle for Republicans like myself who want to support Secretary Clinton for president. To come together, make a statement, be heard, and really communicate with other Republicans primarily about why we think what we do and hope that they'll come along with us.
A lot of Republicans who have expressed reservations about Donald Trump feel very, very nervous about breaking with the party, that it's even more damaging than a Trump victory would be. How do you deal with that in the PAC?
Well, there these are times where people's passions, political passions, run very, very high, probably the highest that we've seen in this country since the 1960s. And so you're not going to convince everybody, obviously. There are going to be folks who believe that they have to remain loyal to the party as an institution in order to protect its future. And, of course, there are actual Trump supporters. But there is also, I think, a very significant number in the millions of people who identify themselves as Republicans that feel that Trump, as I do, is an unacceptable commander-in-chief, simply dangerous to our kids, our grandkids, our future.
So rhetorically speaking, you're kind of calling for a suspension of the traditional debate over the principles of the Democratic Party versus the principles of the Republican Party and saying, hold on, this guy's disqualified. This isn't a matter of I disagree with Donald Trump. This is Donald Trump just does not function as president. He's a dangerous incompetent or something. I don't know how to use it. This is a different kind of argument.
It's got two parts to it, John. One is that in my view and folks who agree with me in the Republican Party, Trump doesn't pass the test that Mayor Bloomberg laid out in his speech at the Democratic Convention. That is, he's not sane and competent. But there's a second part of the argument, which is that I'm not asking anybody to betray the what I consider to be the real principles of the Republican Party. I think that Donald Trump does not represent those principles. I think his ascendancy in the party is some kind of aberrant takeover, if you will, by a portion of the party, a minority of its primary voters, and that there is a possibility for the restoration of what I consider to be sort of real Republican principles after Donald Trump is defeated.
So do you believe this PAC could possibly manage to marginalize Donald Trump as a candidate while at the same time resurrecting and helping down-ballot candidates all over the country in Congress?
Well, I guess that's sort of the grandest statement of the hopes that we have. It all depends on the level of support that we receive. But we're going to try our best to do at least one thing well, and that is give Republican voters who are inclined against Donald Trump, who are willing to look at a vote for Hillary Clinton, to give them the best case for why they should do that and to make them feel kind of safe and comfortable and protected in doing that. If we're able to go beyond that to look at down ballot races, we'll do so, but that's not the primary objective.
Everyone who's had this intellectual sort of soul searching, and it sounds like you've had, and President Obama talked about it yesterday, that You distance yourself from Trump, but then there's a point where you go, you know what? It's too much. I'm out. What was that point for you?
Oh, I was never in. My firm, political consulting firm, had partners within it that represented Donald Trump both in business dealings and in political dealings back as far as the 1990s. So I had the opportunity to watch him and some of his close advisors at pretty close range. I never liked what I saw. I always thought that what people say now about megalomania and sort of instability was present from the creation, so to speak. So I was never on the Trump train and never really had to search my soul about getting off of it. For me, the hard question was about the long-term future of a two-party system in the United States, which I think is indispensable. We have to have a competition for power and we have to have a competition for ideas. And the question is what's the best way to do that in the context of this, you know, sort of unprecedentedly dangerous candidacy?
Well, what do you say to the injured veterans that we spoke with? And we spoke with one yesterday who says, I sacrificed far more than Donald Trump did. I understand what Khazir Khan is saying at the Democratic National Convention, but the worst thing to happen in U.S. history would be Hillary Clinton becoming president.
Well, I just respectfully disagree. Obviously, there are people who have very passionate negative feelings about Secretary Clinton. I believe those feelings are mistaken. I think they've been fanned by 25 years, maybe more, an entire generation of a concerted partisan effort on the part of the more right-wing quarters of the Republican Party to delegitimize her, and I don't think that they reflect accurately her record, her experience, her values. Now, I'm not here, you know, I'm not here to argue the case that Hillary Clinton is going to be the next Abraham Lincoln or Winston Churchill. I don't believe that. If there were other Republican nominees, we wouldn't be having this conversation, and I wouldn't have formed this organization. I'd be supporting the Republican candidate. But this is a unique choice that America has at a unique moment in history, and we have to face where we are. I've been saying to people, you know, you get invited to the banquet, and the RSVP card says chicken or fish. You can write in steak if you want, but they're not going to serve it to you. You got to pick chicken or fish. And in this case, Secretary Clinton, I think, is just abundantly clear that she would be, again, I'm going to quote Mayor Bloomberg, a sane and competent president. You might disagree with her on some policies. You might even have questions about, you know, her sort of political character. But none of those things rises to the level of the really unique danger that I think Donald Trump poses, both in terms of temperament and character, and also in terms of Trumpism, if you will, this, you know, sort of incoherent set of ideas that he's thrown out that hearken to jingoism, to nativism, to racism, to isolationism, to the worst strains in the history of American politics, particularly the way in which America relates to the world.
Paul Ryan and Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell have been challenged by the president and others to sort of face the music here, and that they have a decision to make. They've criticized Trump, but they haven't withdrawn their endorsement. Do you believe they're in that position?
Look, I've worked with both of them. I have respect for both of them, and I have respect for the very great difficulty that they're in the present situation, which really nobody could have imagined for party leaders in terms of whether or not they would support the nominee of their own party. It's a difficult place that they're in politically. And it's a difficult place they're in morally. The president's, free to advise them on how to search their souls. I'm not going to do that. What I'm going to do is look for the people who are like-minded with myself. And there's more and more of them. I mean, I think you're going to see on a daily basis now for the remainder of this campaign, prominent Republicans joining this Republicans for Her movement.
So here's the fun question, Craig, before we go. You get all this money. Do you actually design ads to deliver this message, like outtakes from, the Titanic movie or something? Get off the ship? What do you do?
Well, yes, we are looking to do advertising in targeted states aimed at targeted voting groups. We've actually already made, if people go to our website, republicansforher2016.com, they can see a number of videos, number of ads that we've already made. Look, our primary message is this is an incredibly dangerous moment in world history, with the rise of a resurgent and aggressive Russia, with the Chinese making what people agree to be illegal claims on big portions of the Pacific Ocean, with the international jihadi movement, et cetera. I could go on and on. This is a dangerous time. Some people liken it to the years before the outbreak of World War I. We need a next commander-in-chief who's going to be within the consensus, and there was a consensus that existed between Republicans and Democrats all the way back to Franklin Roosevelt about the fundamentals, the sort of the basic principles of America's role in the world, and the idea that American power in the world, both hard power and soft power, was indispensable to the progress of our people at home and really the progress of humanity. That is all being questioned, denigrated by Trump in his kind of flippant rants. And if you dismantle the architecture that kept the world safe since World War II, you may well get World War III.
Lots to think about there, but it sounds like you do like my Titanic idea.
We'll look at it.
Craig Snyder, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Craig Snyder is chairman of the Republicans for Her Political Action Committee. Clinical depression seems to be as ephemeral as bad luck. It arises out of a murky interaction of unfortunate circumstances, stress, and a loss of hope. It's just one of those things that doesn't feel like a virus or an infection or some genetic disorder. But with the proliferation of DNA data available to researchers in the wake of people taking popular home DNA tests, there's been a promising new breakthrough. Gene testing company 23andMe and Pfizer Pharmaceuticals collaborated to explore the DNA of more than 450,000 people. In this unprecedented pool of big data, they found specific regions in the human genome that could signal a risk of clinical depression. At the head of that research team was Ashley Winslow. She's the neurogenetics director at the University of Pennsylvania's Orphan Disease Center. She worked as a neuroscientist at Pfizer during this study. Dr. Winslow, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thank you for having me.
Now, how could depression be genetically related? Because it seems so much the result of external inputs.
Depression can run in families. Because it's heritable, we would expect to see in studies that there is a genetic component. But surprisingly, to date, we haven't been able to identify those genetic predispositions until actually our study came along, and by accessing such a huge population within the 23andMe research database, we were able to identify 15 different points in the human genome that associate with risk for major depressive disorder.
Now, on the one hand, that's a, a great development. But on the other hand, in genetic sort of molecular nomenclature, you know, you're still looking at a territory the size of Texas, right?
Yes, it's huge.
Yeah. So how do you go? What's the next step?
So the next step is trying to pick apart those 15 different landmarks in the human genome. They don't tell us specifically how the disease is caused. We really have to kind of dig into that research now. So the data points to these landmarks. It says, you know, look over here. There's something going on in this space. Now we need to identify within those regions the specific mutations or genomic changes that cause disease. We need to then identify the genes that are involved in that process and then understand the biology. What goes awry? How do these genes and these genomic changes alter the gene function and cause problems with the downstream biology?
Do these 15 different regions operate independently, which would mean that there are 15 vulnerabilities on the genome for getting depression, or do they behave hierarchically, that like one is more of a controlling region and the others are sort of less involved? But if you get enough of them all together, then that could trigger depression.
Because depression is considered a complex disorder, we really think that it's likely an add-on effect from these different changes, and probably these interact with one another in different ways. They may not all interact with one another. They may also interact with environmental risk factors as well, which we haven't looked at in this study.
And if you were going to look at environmental risk factors, you would look at stress, for instance.
Stress would be a great thing to look at. Also, we know that there is association with exposure to light. So different people in different geographical locations can have an increased predisposition. Early childhood exposure to stress or trauma.
If you were to even think about a preventive therapy for depression, if you could screen for a likelihood that you have this trait, what could that look like? What would it even look like?
Oftentimes, your risk doesn't just rely on your genetics. It's a complex interaction of your environment and other factors that kind of affect the biology in the brain. So it's hard to use genetics in a vacuum in and of itself. But as we start to understand these things more and more, we can integrate more information and get a more holistic picture. And I think that's what we hope for these findings, is that this starts to point us to relevant, novel biological understanding of depression.
Would you say, as the result of this huge database, that depression or these 15 different regions indicates that depression is widespread among humans to the point where it may be some adaptive phenomenon that, you know, relates to circumstances long, long in the past?
Potentially. So we haven't looked at kind of the evolutionary push for why so many people have depression, but it is a very common disease compared to other neurological diseases, and it affects men, women, and people of almost every age group. Our study really dug into the 23andMe database, looking across age ranges from 20 up through over 60, much older individuals. Interestingly, though, there's different types of depression, and we expect there's different subtypes of depression, which may point to different underlying biology and different interactions with the environment. But these are things we have yet to really understand.
I mean, it's possible back in the old days, you know, when food was hard to get, depression was an adaptation that basically said, don't expect too much. The world is a nasty place.
Yeah, potentially. I think that we have a snapshot of what depression means nowadays, and it can be quite hard to get to kind of the evolutionary basis of these findings. But there's a lot of people looking into kind of how data like this might intersect or play out in kind of evolutionary advantage. So that would be another area of study that would be very interesting to look at.
Ashley Winslow is director of neurogenetics at the Orphan Disease Center at the University of Pennsylvania, formerly associate director of neurogenetics at the Pfizer Corporation during this particular study. Thank you so much, doctor.
Thank you for having me.
The Zika virus has apparently found a home in the active nightlife of Miami. A spike of 14 cases of active Zika has motivated the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention to recommend that pregnant women and their partners do not travel to the area. It's the first warning the CDC has ever made on American soil in response to an infectious disease. Joseph Conlon is a mosquito expert and a technical advisor with the American Mosquito Control Association. He joins me now from Jacksonville, Florida. Joseph, welcome.
Thank you.
So you've got a lot of experience all over the world looking at these kinds of things. Does 14 cases an emergency make?
In a matter of speaking, yes, it does, because we've probably got a lot more than 14 cases that we don't even know of. One of the insidious parts about this disease is that only one in five people exhibit symptoms. So you could have four people running around for every one of those cases that we've noted, and they could be infecting other mosquitoes that could be going to infect other people. So it could spread quite a bit without us even knowing it's even there.
Is Zika species dependent in the sense that it only travels with one kind of mosquito?
In a matter of speaking, yes. Aedes aegypti, the yellow fever mosquito, is the primary transmitter of Zika virus, although Aedes albopictus, the Asian tiger mosquito, has been found naturally infected with it also. None of the other mosquito species have been known to transmit this disease. It's primarily Aedes aegypti and Aedes albopictus, both container breeders.
And we reached out to Miami-based OBGYN Dr. Christine Curry on how she is dealing with this and advising her patients.
We want our patients to be using mosquito repellent every time they leave the house, especially if they're pregnant. We want them to wear long sleeves and long pants. We want them to avoid areas where they know that there's likely to be mosquito bites. And then for the area where we know there's ongoing transmission, particularly around the windward area, we advise pregnant patients to not go there if they don't have to.
Is that enough? And I guess people who live in the Miami area don't have much choice.
I think it's very prudent advice. I would also add that people should be getting rid of containers around their houses, emptying out the water and scrubbing the insides of the containers so that the eggs don't hatch out the next time it rains.
Is there an eradication strategy here, or do we simply focus on containment?
Eradication would cost an enormous amount of money, and with this particular species of mosquito is very portable. We need to start going to general quarters over this before it really gets out of hand. We want to contain this in small areas. This outbreak in Miami was not unanticipated. What's going to be the real challenge is when hurricane season hits.
Is there a way in which this could generally transmit all around the country? I mean, mosquitoes are common in the late summer, even in the north.
But the two mosquito species, they are not found in all areas of the country. By and large, they keep themselves to the lower tier of states. However, we've had dengue outbreaks transmitted by the same mosquito historically as far north as Boston. So there's hypothetically we could have transmission up there. People could be bringing eggs along with them and go out to, Fargo, North Dakota. You could start a small transmission cycle there. It's hypothetically, possible.
For those of us who aren't pregnant, if we get Zika, are we then immune from it and it's not a problem at all?
That's unknown at this time. In all likelihood, that is true, because with the other flaviviruses of which Zika is found, one attack confers immunity, but we don't know for certain if that's the case with Zika. Zika has thrown us a couple curveballs here with the sexual transmission you don't find with the other flaviviruses. So it's going to take a long time to determine whether that's true.
How many mosquitoes would you say you've put down in your career?
Not enough. millions, literally millions. It's one of life's simple pleasures.
Joseph Conlon is a technical advisor to the American Mosquito Control Association. Thank you so much, Joe.
You're very welcome.
The Takeaway is supported by Blue Apron, who knows that incredible ingredients make incredible meals. Blue Apron works with a community of artisanal suppliers, family-run farms, sustainable fisheries, and ethical ranchers to deliver perfectly portioned seasonal ingredients and easy-to-follow recipe cards right to your door. Choose recipes based on your preferences with no weekly commitment. Get your first three Blue Apron meals free, plus free shipping, by visiting blueapron.com/takeaway.
In 2016, the refugee crisis has become so huge and urgent that it would be impossible to ignore in this year's Olympics. There may be shame in being a refugee, but there's only pride to be representing the 60 million displaced persons in the world as an Olympic swimmer.
I think I will think about my family and my coach, my friends, and everyone who helped me, actually. And I will think how proud I am of what I did.
That's 18-year-old Syrian swimmer Yusra Mardini, who went from swimming in a pool to swimming for her life as she and her sister Sarah helped push a sinking dinghy with about 20 other Syrian refugees from Turkey to the Greek islands of Lesbos as the families escaped the conflict at home.
Me and my sister were in the water, but actually before, my sister told me, if something happens, don't help anyone. And then she get in the water and she helped them. And it was quite hard just to think that you are a swimmer and in the end you're going to end up dying in the water, who you know the best.
Yusra had already been a top swimmer when she and her family were forced to flee. Now she is one of 10 athletes who make up the first all-refugee Olympic team. Yusra now lives and trains in Germany, a country at the center of the refugee debate. Michael Sherp is with the German Olympic Sports Confederation. He's been closely involved with Yusra and her story as the young Olympian began training again. He says the Olympic refugee team is a great opportunity for both the refugees and the International Olympic Committee.
It's a first. It's a great reaction to one of the biggest political issues we have right now worldwide. If we talk about like 60 or 70 million leaving their countries, an impressive possibility to show that these people have dreams, have goals they are striving at, fighting for, because they can use one of the most important stages and give faces to this anonymous mass of people.
How has Yusra's success mobilized sentiment on this story?
There are different people who have been impressed by her. We have had an international media day because we had to with her, because every morning there were TV teams in the swim and wanted to talk to her, wanted to interview her. And we had, since then, that was in March, we had more than 1,000 requests for interviews, not kidding. This spreading the news and talking about her and her sister saving these people in the Mediterranean and then making it to a safe European country and then making it to the Games is so extraordinary. It gives example and I think hope to other refugees, definitely.
Does she want to become an activist for refugee issues?
She's got a political mind, but I wouldn't say she is right now in the position to be a politician or something like that. She wants to go to Rio, and she's aware that she now has an additional responsibility, not only for herself, for trying to be as good as she can, go there for all the refugees. But I see the difference because she's so much in swimming and preparation. As soon as Yusra has a more normal and regular life again, she will go into that direction.
What's her event?
They are still deciding. It might be 100 freestyle or 200 freestyle.
So that's a really competitive event.
It is. And actually, she and her coach, when they started here, they said, our goal is Tokyo, because she lost 2 years of training almost completely. She was really good when she was 14, 15 at the short lane world championships. She competed with the Syrian relay already, which is early for such a young girl. But then roadblocks on the way to the training. They had an artillery grenade on the roof of the swimming hall. Luckily, no one was in the water. So this is not like train in the US or in Germany. We couldn't imagine how different that was. But she is somewhere near what they call the FINA B standard. Well, to explain it easily, there are standards for country like yours or mine who really are into swimming. There is another standard for countries who are just developing swimming, and Syria would be one of those countries. And she is like 2 or 3 seconds away from that. The IOC, when they made up the team, they said there are 3 parameters we check. Are they really refugees? Are they into elite sports? And are there any personal circumstances that somehow influenced their chances to qualify. And in this case, I think they take into consideration what happened to her in the last 2 years in Syria.
Michael, before we go, I talked with a refugee woman, immigrant, who had spent years and years and years going from Syria to Palestine to Jordan to Russia, finally making it to the United States and finally was sworn in as an American. And she wanted to say something, and she stood up in front of this whole crowd and said, I just want to be a woman. I don't want any other label. And and that's what gave her most relief. When Yusra is in the parade at the Olympics, do you think she and others like her will want to represent a country or be more yearning to be free of all these labels and just be human athletes?
This sounds may sound a little evasive from my side, but in her heart, she just wants to be a swimmer. That's one point. And now that she knows she is part of a certain community, she wants to represent them as well. And she's very, very proud of her country. It's I think, in her heart and in her mind, it will be a cocktail or a mixture of emotions and feeling of responsibilities. And I won't describe it as a load or something making her soul heavy, but it is something which you don't usually have as a human being.
Michael Sherp, the best of luck to Yusra. Thanks so much for speaking with us.
Best to you.
Yusra Mardini and the Olympic refugee team, all making history at the opening ceremony in Rio on Friday night.
Lenny Bruce is gone, but his spirit's living on and on.
You might say that legendary comedian Lenny Bruce's biggest problem was that he was just born at the wrong time.
San Francisco, I got arrested for... we can hear that, Daddy. I'm not going to repeat the word because I want to finish the gig here tonight. It's they said it was vernacular for a favorite homosexual practice, a 10-letter word. It's really chic. That's 2 4-letter words and a preposition. I can't... I wish I could tell you the word. It starts with a C. Well, you know what the word is.
50 years ago, the controversial satirist Lenny Bruce died of a drug overdose. Born Leonard Alfred Schneider, the Navy veteran-turned-comedian toured the world. He pushed the boundaries of what was considered vulgar at the time and often paid for it. His commentary on the insanity of modern life and his battles with lawyers was very entertaining.
Swear that he didn't. What did he say? Your Honor, he said blah, blah, blah. The judge, he said blah, blah, blah. Then the guy really yented it up. That's right. Yeah, I didn't believe it. There was a guy up on the stage in front of women in a mixed audience saying blah, blah, blah. The judge. This I never heard. Blah, blah, blah.
Bruce was not a happy fellow, whether by design or because of all the slings and arrows he attracted. On his grave is the epitaph, "Beloved Father, Devoted Son, Peace at Last." Sarah Shoemaker is an associate university librarian for archives and special collections at Brandeis University, where she oversees a collection of Lenny Bruce's personal letters, photographs, and recordings. Sarah says his work remains relevant today, 50 years after his death.
More than his humor, I think his legacy holds up. Certainly, there have been his fans and champions over the last decades who have never lost interest. Other comedians and social critics have carried on elements of his legacy. And I think his work and his persona and his point still have a place in the contemporary conversation, even if his humor seems from a different age.
Marijuana, I never smoked pot, I never dug it. It's a schlepo high. It's, it'll probably be legal. I figured it'd be legal in about 3 years. Most of the law students I know smoke marijuana, that's why. And
was he aware that he was a first to confront the government on these issues of free speech from an entertainer's perspective?
Was he aware of that? That's a good question. I mean, I think another way to ask that question is, was he aware of being a pioneer? And I think certainly his legal battles put him in that position, and he certainly would have been aware of the effect that those conversations were having on the public, on his own humor, whether or not it was funny. He certainly led the way in being transgressive, and I think in linking his comedy and his life to the very laws that govern our society, he was pushing it as a legal conversation as well as a cultural one and as well as a humor conversation.
Religion recognizes decency where the Constitution doesn't. There's no decent and indecent. The Constitution only recognizes that all people, when they are illegal, are immoral. And then they get busted and they're indecent. And that's where it's at.
What do you think he would say about the general level of language in entertainment today? I mean, would he go, oh, I died for their sins? Or would he say, well, that was a waste of time?
Well, that's an excellent question. It's hard to know. We'll never know how age might have changed Lenny Bruce or even how he himself might have continued to affect the age that he lived in had he lived. But I think certainly he crossed lines. He did so deliberately. And comic figures from Falstaff to Sarah Silverman in drama, in fiction, in real life, have often taken that role in order to get us to look at something larger.
Do you think Sarah Silverman and Lenny Bruce would have been pals?
I imagine it would have been a fun conversation to be a part of.
The personal life of Lenny Bruce, how much of that comes through in this material?
Well, that, I think, is a really interesting side of what's revealed in this material. As I mentioned, he really reveals his human side, his letters to his father, which were genuinely affectionate, his pride in his newborn daughter, the family photos from before he was famous. I think all of that really shows a side of warmth that is harder to see from just his stand-up act. Also, the irrepressibility of his expression and his wit. He often wrote things down on whatever was handy, a ticket stub or a page from a book. Really couldn't resist making a comment about almost anything he saw. And I think another piece of this that's interesting today is hearing his voice. The collection includes audio material, which was recently digitized with a grant from the Grammy Foundation. And some of that is his comedy routines. Some of it is verbal notes. Hearing his voice in a new way, quite literally, is an interesting piece from some years ago, but it's a new way to actually literally hear his voice again.
So he's not like Seinfeld, where he talks the same whether he's doing stand-up or whether he's just sort of talking to you.
Well, it's interesting. I think certainly his style has been described before as vocal jazz, and that's very much what it is. And some of his audio recorded notes are more stream of consciousness, less polished, still compelling.
Tragic figure? Does that come through in this archive?
It does to me. I think that seeing him as a real human and a family man and as somebody with warm personal connections and a depth of feeling that might not always show in his comedy, when you know exactly how all of this ended, he does strike me as a tragic figure, yes.
Well, I asked you a moment ago about, you know, all the obscenity that you see in entertainment today and what he would think about that, but perhaps the better question is, what would he think about this election?
I would love to hear his comments on that. I wouldn't be able to supply them in my imagination, but I have no doubt that he would have a lot of interesting things that people would very much be interested in hearing.
Sarah Shoemaker is Associate University Librarian for Archives and Special Collections at Brandeis University. Thanks so much, Sarah.
Thanks very much. My pleasure.
And here's something to take with you today. It was an early warning from privacy researchers, but there is now firm evidence that the helpful low battery indicator that lets you know you need to plug in has another purpose. It enables tracking online. When battery life is expressed as a percentage and time remaining, it delivers a kind of digital fingerprint. Just more data about all of us that companies can buy and sell. It just goes to show that in this era, we are never truly lost. We may just feel that way. Here's a salute to a singer who still has plenty of life left in him.
good life. Full of fun seems to be the ideal.
I'll have what he's having. Very happy birthday to Tony Bennett, who turns 90 today. Respond to anything you heard on today's program. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or leave a comment at thetakeaway.org or at facebook.com/thetakeaway. Thanks so much for listening. Thank you, Tony. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by TIAA. Whether it's investing, advice, banking, or retirement, TIAA is committed to helping those who do good do well. Learn more at TIAA.org. The Henry Luce Foundation, for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. The Takeaway's resilience reporting is supported by the Rockefeller Foundation. For more, go to rockfound.org.
To be free and explore the unknown.
PRI, Public Radio International.